is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America.
Hello and welcome. Welcome to VOA Africa. Thank you for joining us. I'm Yehia Suhib in Washington. Coming up on Africa News Tonight, diplomats are trying to broker a deal to bring Ethiopia back from the brink of all-out civil war. And the Economic Community of West African States, ECOWAS, has imposed new individual sanctions on Mali and Guinea. All these and more on Africa News Tonight. We start with our top story. South Africa's ruling African National Congress is struggling to find coalition partners as it tries to hold on to power in scores of cities and towns. These follows local government elections last week that resulted in the party dipping below 50% of the vote for the first time since Nelson Mandela swept it to power in 1994. Now, unless it gets support from smaller parties, the ANC will lose control of 61 key municipalities, including South Africa's economic hub and biggest city, Johannesburg. Darren Taylor reports.
The Inkatha Freedom Party, the IFP, has become the latest major political organization to refuse to enter into coalitions with the ANC. The IFP's strong in KwaZulu-Natal, and its decision seems certain to result in the ruling party losing several municipal areas in the province. Unsurprisingly, chief opposition party, the Democratic Alliance, the DA, has also said no to the ANC, as has New Force, Action SA.
So those are three big doors slamming shut in the ANC's face.
Independent political analyst Wayne Sussman says the only big party that's unequivocally said it's willing to partner with the ANC is the Economic Freedom Fighters, the EFF. He says the EFF got enough votes in the polls to make it powerful enough to save the ANC's rule in some cities and towns. But that won't be an easy marriage, says Sussman.
We also know what the EFF wants. And they want expropriation of land without compensation to be passed within the next 6 months. They want a state bank to be created, to sit in government with fellow coalition partners. Those demands are going to be very difficult for the ANC to agree on. So this means that we're in a very interesting time right now.
One of the few positives emerging for the ANC after the polls, says Sussman, is its strength in northern Limpopo province. But he adds, even there, signs abound of people being fed up with the party's misrule and corruption, like in the municipality of Thaba Zimbi.
Again, the ANC falling short of 50%. The DA, the Freedom Front, the EFF, and a local party called the Thaba Zimbi Residents Association, they can gang up on the ANC again, but there's a new party, another new Thaba Zimbi local party, who the ANC can hopefully get to support them, and then they can take Thaba Zimbi back. Limpopo has actually been one of the better areas for the ANC, and I think that's got a lot to do with the popularity of President Cyril Ramaphosa.
Sussman says the ANC is surely deeply concerned at its dramatic loss of support in areas that were once its fortresses.
When Jacob Zuma was ruling the ANC, never in a million years would you find a municipality in southern KwaZulu-Natal where the ANC fall under 50%. So across the province of KwaZulu-Natal, including the most important municipality, the metro of eThekwini, the ANC found itself in a dire strait. And when we...
People are even turning against the ANC in the Eastern Cape, home province of many ANC icons, including Nelson Mandela.
In Nelson Mandela Bay and towards the west, the municipality called Bayers Nordia, Graaf Reinet, the ANC is under 50% there as well.
Meanwhile, calls are growing for the DA to find some common ground with Ramaphosa's so-called new ANC. They say if that doesn't happen, the ANC will be driven increasingly into the arms of the EFF and will have to implement some of its radical policies, with disastrous consequences for South Africa. So far, though, the DA says it's not in the business of saving the ANC and plans on crushing the ruling party and the EFF at the national polls in 2024. For VOA News, I'm Darren Taylor in Johannesburg.
The Global Monitoring for Environmental Security Africa project plans to launch a cell phone app which will make it easy for farmers to access Earth observation data from satellites. As the Earth observation lead for the project in South Africa, Professor Timothy Dube of the University of the Western Cape in South Africa explains this can help them plan grazing and crops, manage water scarcity, and deal with climate and weather hazards. He spoke with reporter Vicky Stark.
Dube says the evidence is clear. Climate change is happening and at a rapid rate. He says the Global Monitoring for Environmental Security Africa, which is funded by the African and European Unions, wants to help people be better prepared. Dube says Africa has been at a disadvantage due to limited data.
For instance, be it weather data or any form of data, environmental data, crop data, settlements data, that can be used, for instance, in modeling, a sort of deriving information on which areas are likely to be prone to flooding. This has made it very difficult to sort of plan ahead. One of the issues is because in most African countries, issues to do with the data sharing are a problem. So now, because of the GMES Africa project, they are bringing a new ideas, particularly where we have to use satellite data, which has got a huge footprint.
Dube says the project currently relies on Earth observation satellite data from NASA in the United States and the European Space Agency.
We have been lagging behind as Africa in that particular area, but through the GMES Africa, now we've got what we call the AU space policy. This space policy actually is advancing issues to do with Earth observation and its applications in Africa. So now, South Africa, one of the universities in the Western Cape will be hosting a program that particularly provides training on Earth observation. And we have got a space development that will be hosted in Egypt.
Dube says the Global Monitoring for Environmental Security Africa project has 13 different focuses on the continent. He says in Southern Africa, they are concentrating on wetlands.
Because in wetlands, considering that the environment is changing now, we're experiencing a lot of droughts, climate change, and which means there are a lot of resources that are sort of getting depleted, particularly grazing resources, food-related resources, mainly for communities around these areas. So we're trying to find ways in which we can use Earth observation data to sort of enhance decision-making by different stakeholders, those who make policies for wetland or conservation related in wetland areas, or those who depend on wetland, particularly rural community people and farmers who base their livelihood basically on these sort of resources.
One such farmer is Thomas Nika of Zimbabwe.
I think what is important is that the project generally assists us in planning in light of the climate change challenges. So generally the project is assisted us to understand the ecological conditions of the wetlands in terms of the soils, in terms of the water, how long does it last in the wetlands, and what are the changes that may be happening.
Dube says they have an online portal that was developed in consultation with stakeholders like farmers. They also have what he calls citizen scientists based in communities to help others access this information.
So we stayed with the users for the users. That has been our motto. In phase two, what we are now trying to do so that we bring this information more close to farmers, we are now planning to develop apps that they can access via cell phones.
Started in 2018, phase two of the project will begin on February 1st. This is Vicky Stark for VOA News in Cape Town.
Diplomats are trying to broker a deal to bring Ethiopia back from the brink of all-out civil war as both the rebels and the government officials swap accusations. It is difficult to determine the accuracy of claims by both sides due to lack of access to the front lines. 9 rebel groups say they have joined forces against the governments and say they have advanced within 40 kilometers of the capital Addis Ababa. The government has rejected suggestions the rebels are within striking distance of Addis Ababa, but has ordered the capital to prepare to defend itself, while foreign embassies have withdrawn staff. The government accused rebellious Tigrayan forces today of killing 100 youths in the town of Kombolcha. The Tigrayan forces, led by Tigray People's Liberation Front, TPLF, denied the allegation. The African Union's High Representative for the Horn of Africa, Olusegun Obasanjo, met yesterday with TPLF leader Debretsion Gebremichael in Tigray's capital, Mekelle. The same day, the UN Undersecretary for Humanitarian Affairs, Martin Griffith, also visited Mekelle. Sudanese pro-democracy groups launched 2 days of civil disobedience and strikes yesterday to protest last month's military takeover. However, according to Reuters, the commander of Sudan's powerful rapid support forces, the number two man in Sudan's military, General Mohamed Hamdan Dagalo, justified the takeover in a midnight speech posted on Facebook. He said his boss, General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan, acted to correct the course of the people's revolution and preserve the security and stability of the country. Meanwhile, local resistance committees and the Sudanese Professional Association are organizing a campaign of protests and barricades to try to reverse the military takeover. Yesterday, there were protest demonstrations in the capital Khartoum, as well as in the cities of Madani, Nayala, and Atbara. While reports indicate that some 87 people were arrested in several areas in eastern Khartoum. Across the river on the Ombada area of Omdurman, police used tear gas to break up protests. The military takeover in Sudan has halted a power-sharing arrangement between the military and civilians that had been agreed after Omar al-Bashir's overthrow and was meant to lead to democratic elections by late 2023. Two Libyan families have filed a civil lawsuit in a U.S. federal court in Virginia, accusing Khalifa Haftar, commander of the Libyan National Army, LNA, of war crimes, human rights abuses, and torture during a 2016-2017 offensive to seize a key Libyan district. Judge Leonie Brinkema has ordered Haftar to comply with the plaintiff's request to give statements by October 28th. The U.S. federal judge said she would rule against Haftar if he failed to attend the hearing. Asabo Mish, president of the American-Libyan Alliance, discussed the latest in that procedure with VOA senior analyst Mohamed Al-Shenawi.
This weekend we got an offer from his lawyers to have Haftar appear November 9th in front of the court. So this changes the dynamics a little bit. In one way, we still need him to answer questions that are accompanying the discovery process. And his lawyers have failed to provide any answer to these questions, whereas the majority of the questions related to the crimes that he has committed have not been answered. And so the question is, how can the appearance in front of the court be sufficient if these answers are not complied with? But the lawyers are negotiating with the court regarding either a summary judgment as a default judgment because he has failed to appear up until now and has not answered the interrogatories, or in fact, that if he does agree to the November 9th appearance date, then we need his lawyers to comply with answering the interrogatory. So it's still back and forth. He is, I think, realizing the seriousness of this case against him. And he's realizing that if he does not appear in front of the court, and if he is given a default judgment as an indictment, that it could very much jeopardize any political future he may have in Libya.
U.S. federal judge said she would rule against Haftar if he failed to attend the hearing. If the court legally charged Haftar in this lawsuit, how could that impact his position as a presidential candidate in Libya?
So a couple of things. Now with the new development of him deciding that he may agree to appear on November 9th, the possibility of a default judgment may not be likely, although it's still being deliberated violated by the judge because of the interrogatories that I mentioned earlier. The other thing is, this is a court that is done with the jury, and it has been assigned dates that are in January. So January 18th for one case and January 22nd for the other case, which means that it could come after the elections. If, in fact, Haftar's legal team complies with the court requirements, including appearing in front of the court and including answering the interrogatory. But with all that in flux now and in motion, if Haftar is legally charged in this lawsuit, we believe that it will put a lot of strain on his ability to continue as a presidential candidate. But in terms of its impact in Libya law, that's where it's unfortunate. We do not see sufficient action within the Libyan legal system, within the Libyan public opinion, as well as court system, as well as the government, in limiting his ability to run as a presidential candidate.
So how could the Congressional Libya Stabilization Act impact Haftar's chances in the upcoming presidential elections?
What's interesting about the Congressional Libya Stabilization Act is Haftar is also a U.S. citizen. And so he is, in fact, liable in front of U.S. laws as an American citizen. And much of the laws in the Libya Stabilization Act speak to the legality and the legal consequences of those who have committed certain crimes, of which Haftar is particularly identified. The third section in the first part of the Libya Stabilization Act speaks specifically about the Libyan National Army, which is Haftar's militia, and speaks specifically about acts of criminality that is committed by Haftar, whether it's through the Wagner mercenaries, or whether it's through working with Bashar al-Assad's regime, or whether it's by committing the degree of crimes that Haftar has committed.
That was Assam Omish, president of the American-Libyan Alliance, speaking with my colleague, Mohammed Al-Shanawi. The Economic Community of West African States has imposed new individual sanctions on Mali and Guinea. ECOWAS Commission President Jean-Claude Cassibro told the French news agency AFP that new sanctions were imposed against Mali's transitional leaders because they informed ECOWAS they would not be able to hold presidential and legislative elections in February. Mali's interim government, which took power following the military overthrow of President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita in August 2020, had promised ECOWAS to oversee an 18-month transition back to democracy, culminating in elections on February 27, 2022. As far as Guinea was concerned, the ECOWAS Commission president said, new sanctions were imposed because Guinea's deposed president, Alpha Conde, 83, is still under house arrest, and the leader of the coup, interim president, Mamadi Doumbouya, is not sure when he will organize elections. The Eastern Democratic Republic of Congo has battled militia violence for decades. In the past several days, an attack on a village near the town of Beni in North Kivu province left 3 civilians dead. The armed forces of the DRC said the attackers were with the Allied Democratic Forces, an Islamist group that has been linked to the Islamic State militants. And on Wednesday, a little-known group struck the city of Bukavu, killing 2 civilians, 2 police officers, and a soldier. The South Kivu province government says 6 rebels were killed in the fighting. Journalist Jafar Al-Katanti in the city of Goma has been following the attacks. He spoke with VOA's Kate Pound-Dawson about the new militant force.
There was a lot of attack in North Kivu, in Ituri, and in South Kivu. But for this week, it's in new areas. In North Kivu, there was an attack in Lubero territory. Some people are saying it can be ADF, but the operating mode was not the same, because ADF attack more population than the army. But the Tuesday's attack attacked both population and FRDC position.
Now, the attack on Bukavu, that was quite a serious one. What do we know about that?
Yes, the attack of Bukavu was a serious one because they attacked all the city, more than 20 positions at the same moment for more than 5 hours. And it's a new group. They are called the Coalition of Congolese Patriots for the 64 article of our constitution, and their leaders are in Europe. They attacked Bukavu as their first front line, but the idea is to leave out the power of Tshisekedi in Kinshasa. They want to control the country. According to them, the country is occupied by foreign as Rwanda and Uganda, and the power of Kinshasa called nothing.
This coalition of Congolese patriots for Article 64, it primarily is politically motivated. It is not an Islamist group. It is politically motivated, and they want to oust the president and his cabinet. Is that correct?
Yes. It's not an Islamic group, and a lot of them, their politic bureau is a group of people living in Europe.
So then the other question is, what is the military saying about this new group and how they can fight it? The attack on Bukavu seems very well planned, very well organized.
Yes, the attack of Bukavu was organized, but after 5 hours, the army succeeded to control the situation. And till now, the army still captured some 20 rebels, and they say they are ready to respond for any event if they try again to attack. But people are afraid because we don't know where are them based. They start attacking Bukavu, but maybe the second attack will not be Bukavu, will be somewhere else, and no one know. Those who captured said about, we are many and we are in the old country and we come to change the power.
That was reporter Jafar Al-Khatanti in Goma speaking with VOA editor Kate Pound-Dawson. And that wraps up this edition of Africa News Tonight. I'm Yehiyas Wahib in Washington. For all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voanews.com. On behalf of our producer, Mokbili Abaro, thank you again for tuning in and choosing the Voice of America.
I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's newsmaker interview program. Join us each Saturday and Sunday when we talk with authors, analysts, and policymakers who provide fresh insight on topics ranging from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on the radio or online at voanews.com/PCUSA. While you're visiting our website, be sure to subscribe to our podcast. We'd also love to hear from you. Just send an email to pcusa@voanews.com or connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/CarolCastielVOA or on Twitter at CarolCastielVOA. That's Press Conference USA every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
The Voice of America's Global News Program, International Edition, brings you an in-depth look at the biggest news stories of the day. Nobody covers the world more comprehensively than VOA. Our correspondents gather the news and the views of the most seasoned experts on international issues. Tune in Monday through Friday at 3:30 and 1705 UTC on The Voice of America.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bobo music to hip life, bonga flavor to soukous, Afrobeat to ndombolo and makossa to kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and